ranked one of America's top research universities, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries on UWM today. Here's the host, Tom Lujack, Vice Chancellor of University Relations.
The study of history has always been one of the cornerstones of our educational system. Knowing what people have done in the past is essential to understanding the world that we live in today. On this edition of UWM Today, we're going to explore an area of history that's become increasingly important in our society. It's called public history. You may not have heard of the term before, but you almost certainly have seen the product of what public historians do. Joining us in the studio today are Jasmine Allender and Nan Kim, both associate professors of history at UWM, and Chris Cantwell, an assistant professor of history at UWM's College of Letters and Science. And Chris, let's start with you. A basic definition, a public historian. Who are you? And what are public historians?
Yeah, it is a really easy question to start with. Public history is both sort of an object of study and sort of an arena of practice. And what I mean by that is sort of public historians study how history is sort of taught and understood outside of the classroom. So in museums, libraries, historic sites, monuments, which have been in the news quite a bit lately. And so public historians will consider just what kind of messages objects like that will tell. And then as practitioners, we also teach students who, you know, aspire to work in places like that, who want to be museum educators or professionals or archivists or curators in museums across the country. So it's both an arena of scholarship as well as an arena of practice.
So is the content that you might find on examples of public history, whether it's a plaque or in a museum as you're walking through, is that content any different from what you would see in a textbook, in the classroom itself, in your lectures, Jasmine?
It depends on what kind of public history you're looking at. So there's sort of different kinds of degree and different points of public, I would say, collaboration. So one of the key tenets that we try to practice in our public history program is the idea of shared authority, so that we are, you know, experts in certain fields of history, but for community-based historical projects, we really rely on the public and their expertise and whatever authority that they bring to the project. So it's a more collaborative practice than you would find in a textbook that's written by usually a single author or a few authors.
Is a public historian, for them to be successful, do they need to be trained in the methods of gathering history and framing history, Nan?
So that's actually one of the things that we can provide as a public history program, and also as public historians working with the community, is that we bring various tools and as well as perspectives. So our students we have a graduate program, and our students are graduate students in the history department specializing in public history. So they are working with sources and training to think historically, but then also in terms of the tools such as working, Chris is teaching a course in podcasting, or they'll be working in terms of using digital tools, as well as training to be oral historians. So there are an array of different methods. In terms of the methodology, that also is evolving and changing. And so our program, in that respect, is bringing the research side as well as the practice.
Chris, I want to talk more about that podcasting class in just a minute, because it does speak to the way in which technology has come into play. When you meet people in the community who are looking at their past, their family's past, or an organization that they might have belonged to, is it important for them to have a conversation with someone like you or Jasmine or Nan who train people in methodology? Or can you produce perfectly good history without necessarily having the same rigor that you would find in the scholarship that you folks do?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, it really comes down to this principle of shared authority that Jasmine alluded to earlier, that that, you know, historical scholarship is not the product of one person's imagination, but it actually emerges out of the space between scholars and the wider community, so that we have a certain skill set to sort of preserve stories and to sort of to set stories within a wider context of sort of larger histories. But we obviously haven't experienced the history that the communities around us have. And so we want to bring sort of our insight into the stories they tell, as well as sort of learning from them themselves. I mean, we talk about digital tools a little bit, and I've come to determine that, you know, digital tools are just helping us do the hard work of reaching out to people, right? So that it becomes a platform to have those kind of face-to-face interactions more so than just doing, you know, creating a website or some sort of audio story, that it sort of gets you in the community and talking to people. And that's where history really happens.
How do you avoid bias from being introduced into the retelling of history? If someone is too close to an experience or an environment, and they are doing work that you might qualify as public history, is there a way to make sure that you fact check or truth check folks who may think that they know exactly what happened, but allow their own prejudices or maybe family opinion to enter into the judgment that is displayed?
That's a really good question, Tom. And especially, I think, when it comes to oral history, it's more interesting, actually, as a historian, for me to think about why would someone choose to remember something in the way that they're telling that story. So there could be purposeful omissions. It could be that they're remembering things in ways that maybe through other kinds of archival research or other memories, other oral histories, we can show that it doesn't corroborate with what happened. But then you have to ask the question, what are the stakes involved in having someone's memory reflect a past that in fact didn't occur? So bias, it's our job to look at as many sources as we can and try to figure out, bring in as many different perspectives as possible and tell the most accurate story that we can.
Everybody has their own story to tell, though, don't they, Nan?
Indeed. I mean, I think that what's also, we have to remember that one of the objectives of in public history is the fact that you're recognizing that not all sources are already documented. And so we can be much more proactive in terms of seeking out some of the stories that might not otherwise ever be recorded. And just as when we're working with sources from regarding the historical past, being able to find these different perspectives and understanding that inherently everyone will have their own sense of bias. That's how we approach sources. And so kind of understanding that that is by nature, in order to record a different experience, people will be coming from their own position. And that itself is valuable to recognize, as well as then it raises questions that otherwise might be might not be evident.
You know, one of the benefits for me of having three public historians in the studios, is that you each have your own story to tell. And so I'm going to go around and ask for some examples of ways in which you have been able to put into practice public history. And Chris, why don't we start with you? What sort of work have you done, either in your research or in your teaching, that stands out as great examples of mm-hmm. public history?
Yeah, I think my story might be somewhat of a common one in that I think I always was a public historian in certain ways, but didn't know it until somebody told me that word later on, which came much later in my education. So I'm actually a product of the UW system. I went to UW-Eau Claire, where I got my undergraduate degree in history. And my first job out of college was working for the Wisconsin Historical Society, Wisconsin State Historical Society, excuse me, because I thought if I wanted to be a historian, I should work in an archive where I learn where collections are processed and how sort of information is gathered. And then from where I went to get my graduate degree and worked for the New York Council for the Humanities, where I ran community book groups in upstate New York on sort of labor history to help sort of deindustrializing communities understand their own past. And then my longest job out of graduate school was at the Newberry Library in Chicago, where I helped direct the Scholl Center for American History. And all along that process, I was sort of, you know, designing projects that helped the community sort of engage with the past. And I always thought it was a part of my practice, but it was, you know, what I was realizing, it was actually making me a better historian as well, better storyteller, gave me a better ability to sort of refine stories so that people would engage with them and listen to them. And it wasn't only until recently that I'm like, oh, I thought I was just a historian, right? But then I also realized that there's this broader field that I'm now a part of that sort of engages the community and has that as its central focus.
So serving as a catalyst to get or help people to look at what stories they have to tell.
Right, right.
How about you, Jasmine? I know that you are a proficient researcher and very, very productive in terms of programs that you're involved in. Give us examples of your public history work.
So I have a little bit of a similar story, at least to the beginning of Chris's. And I was trained, or am trained, as an art historian. My PhD is in art history. And I didn't really know what public history was either until I became a historian. And for me, I came to it through museums and through the critical analysis of museum exhibitions. So in my work on Japanese-American incarceration during World War II and photography, the memory of the incarceration became a topic that was interesting to me, and I wanted to look at how museums were representing that past. So that was my first sort of entrance. And then once I came to Milwaukee and started in the public history program here, one of the first projects I became connected with was through a community member reaching out to me and my senior colleague at the time, Michael Gordon, as public historians wanting help to commemorate the 40th anniversary of the open housing marches in Milwaukee. So we teamed up with a really wide group of community members from across the city. And over a year and a half, this was in 2006, 2007, when Vel Phillips was still alive and was a member of the coordinating committee, created a series of events to commemorate that anniversary, including a play that was written and performed, an exhibition at Wisconsin Black Historical Society, a day-long conference that I organized at UWM, and then we had a march back over the 16th Street Viaduct. An oral history project came out of that as well. And then somehow 10 years went by, and we just celebrated the 50th anniversary of the open housing marches. So that was really a community call to fill a need and wanting professional historians, you know, at UWM to be part of the process, which I'm really grateful for. It really taught me so much about the city and the place that I now call home. So, you know, there's learning happening on both sides.
And how neat that that the community didn't have to wait for an academic to come along who decided that would be a field of study that they chose to follow. The community itself said, we have to preserve this, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, responding to a community need and desire to document and commemorate this past.
Yeah. Nan, how about you? What's your story when that tied you to public history?
Well, what's kind of interesting is that I work on Northeast Asia, and I and war memory and areas of that aren't, in a sense, part of the field of public history. But more recently, in, let's say, the past 5 or 7 years, the field itself has opened out to become much more proactive in expanding toward this what's now called transnational public history, to realize that public history is practiced in many different contexts. And so although I have been in the department for a number of years, I hadn't been teaching in public history only since the last few years, in the sense that I had been really identifying, because my research is in a subfield called memory studies, looking at how this divide between memory and history, as well as how memory can be used politically, and also this intervention of oral history or of the memories of ordinary people, and how that really can redefine how we commemorate the past, or also how we can interpret the past. So my own research has been about Korea and about divided Korea. And this, my own background is, I was trained as a cultural anthropologist, and you can just see from the public history faculty at our program, it is a very interdisciplinary field inherently. And so I also have a background in journalism and creative nonfiction, and so that is kind of my start as far as taking this approach, in the sense that many years ago, when I had been a daily journalist, it was around the time of one of these crises that had occurred, regarding North Korea, and I was in a newspaper, working at a newspaper as a daily reporter in an area where there was a large Korean American community, and my job was to find out the reaction and to write a story, and I was struck. This was in the early 90s, and so this is 1993, and so at the time I was. It was struck that the community was extremely divided in terms of its opinions about how to interpret what was going on, but also realizing that in the larger press, there were very few stories about Koreans themselves, ordinary Koreans, who were most involved. They looked at it geopolitically. They looked at the strategic aspects. And I think that really was the kind of the roots of the projects that I'm doing now, which is about the stories of families who were separated between North and South Korea for now over almost 70 years. So
you've really put the public into public history, I mean, literally, as you think about the work you've done in the Korean community.
Yeah. So actually, my research in Korea, the way in which public history also differs between in the U.S. and abroad, when you have a situation like in Korea where in past military authoritarian governments, there was an action of suppression of history or of certain historical narratives. So the role for oral historians, as well as the collaborations between survivors, bereaved family members, and academics, is actually one where there's a close it's a collaborative sense of, and that's really, I think, one of the tenets or principles of public history is this democratic production of knowledge, and really trying to kind of open out, the different perspectives that are available in order to understand a period of time.
You're listening to UWM Today here on WUWM. Good to have you with us this week. Joining us in the studio today, three public historians, all part of the faculty at UW-Milwaukee's Department of History in the College of Letters and Science, Jasmine Allender, Nan Kim, and Chris Cantwell. Chris, you mentioned podcast and the work that you're doing in that area. I'd like to talk about technology, both in terms of podcast and how our other guests today see technology affecting the ability to capture and build stories, narratives that are rooted in history. For you, technology is central to the way in which you practice history?
It is. There's a school of thought that says you should have specialized sort of digital history classes where you focus on all the the digital tools and pieces of technology you can do to sort of gather, interpret, and share history. But I've actually kind of come full circle on this where I now see, every class I teach as having some sort of technological component that, you can't escape this as a medium to sort of interpret and share the past. So for example, I like to treat my classrooms as laboratories where we don't just talk about public history, but we actually go out and do it. So in my local history research methods class, I've developed a project where students work in pairs to work with local places of worship and then go work with them to tell their stories. So they do research in archival records. They go to the place of worship themselves to sort of look at material that's, hiding in the basement, but then also, take a recorder down with them and do some oral histories or even do some ethnographies of field recordings of worship service so we can capture, what these communities are doing right now. And in the spring, we'll actually be putting this all together to launch it as a site we call Gathering Places, which is sort of a look at religion and community in Milwaukee and sort of the seven places of worship my students work with, looked at the first time, will be launched. And then in the spring, we'll look at seven more and hopefully build this kind of living archive of Milwaukee's religious diversity.
And Jasmine, your degree is in history of art. How has technology affected the way in which you study art today?
And the way I study art and the way I study history and the way I teach history, it's impacted it enormously. So the project that I mentioned before, working on Milwaukee civil rights history, that became a digital humanities project. And in 2010, we launched the March on Milwaukee Civil Rights History Project, which is a digital archive of documents, oral histories, WTMJ TV news film footage, and photographs related to this history. And I incorporate that archive often in my teaching. So students are using digital tools in order to analyze the past. In my own research, it's pulled me into different kinds of projects that incorporate a lot of different kinds of media. And it's allowed us to share that history and construction or curation of the past to a much wider audience than we could have before. So recently, I was just part of a project that launched last fall called The Orange Story. And it was a project where I worked with filmmakers, actually fiction filmmakers based out of Chicago. They created a short film about a Japanese-American man just before while he's closing his store and packing up his belongings to go to a camp during World War II. And we created a website that shows the film, and there's breaks, sort of chapter breaks in the film, and there's archival materials that I curated that follow those breaks that sort of give you historical context to what you've just seen happen in the movie. And I can't imagine doing that kind of project before the kind of digital tools that we have available with us and the online access that we all of us take for granted, I think, at this point.
Yeah, that's really a neat application of technology and making that subject matter come alive. Mm-hmm. Nan, earlier you talked about memory and the way in which you study memory and how it has an impact on history. Do you think because we have so many digital assets available, whether it's the film collection that Jasmine spoke about or the current podcast, does that mean that we're going to remember better? Because we have something to keep us honest and remind us what really happened?
Oh, wow. That's quite a fascinating question. I think of, you know, how when you have one an impairment in one sense, then your other senses actually improve. I'm a little worried about the inverse, that actually we could rely too much on our recorded. I mean, you'll often see in field research that people will be taking, you know, video recordings and instead of actually being present at the place. And so that it does affect kind of the scene as well as a researcher. I'm often tempted to try to gather as much as I can, and you could actually miss some of the encounters.
I'm thinking of my pictures of my grandchildren where I'm taking movies and I have to say, put it down, put down the iPhone and just focus on the moment, right?
Indeed, because actually when we're doing, you know, we have to not mistake the documentation with the other aspect, which is if not anything more important, which is the relationships that you're building. Because then, you know, if you sit down and try to record an oral history with someone that you have actually, you know, spent time in terms of developing this relationship and being there for their programs or writing for their newsletter and doing these things, it's an entirely different conversation than if you just kind of walked in or just tried to, you know, call on the phone and do a cold call instead of or sit down. And that's part of the, you know, that respect when we talked about the shared authority, that we are not the authorities of the experience that we're documenting. And so that relationship is one that I think also requires some restraint when it comes to the possibilities for this, the technological documentation, right, of the events that we're witnessing.
This is an issue that we're all grappling with. There's a well-known public historian, Roy Rosenzweig, who talked about the problem of scarcity versus the problem of abundance. So in the past, historians, you're reliant physically to travel to an archive, whatever archive happens to be open and available and whatever you can get your hands on, that's the material that you can use to do your research. And now we're sort of on the opposite end of the scale where it's the problem of abundance. There's so much that's now digitized, online, accessible, available. It's hard to then you're filtering. What do I need to pay attention to? What should I be looking at? How do I figure out what the hierarchy of information is? So these are all kinds of digital literacy, I think, issues that we certainly bring into the classroom.
Chris, what sort of jobs do public historians have? Give our listeners some examples of what you could do with a history degree having studied public history.
Right. Yeah, I mean, in a lot of ways, there are the kind of traditional and expected pathways that a public historian would take, which is to find themselves either in a museum, a library, or historic site. But oftentimes, I think, you know, there's a lot of surprising places where the kind of the skills of a historian is needed in terms of the ability to research and think critically about evidence. And they often find them well their way into a variety of other places. And I know, I think, Jasmine, you did some research on where our students have ended up.
Yeah, actually, we have one of our alums is coming back soon to receive the UWM Alumni Graduate of the Last Decade Award, Mark Speltz. And he has a very interesting career trajectory. When he was a student here in public history, he was the historian at American Girl. So he was doing all the research for the historical doll characters. He wasn't writing the books. He was doing all the historical research and then giving that research to the writer. He got his degree here, and now he is vice president and senior historian at Wells Fargo. So we have students who go in this kind of like more corporate track. Other students, I can think of students who work at the Department of Defense, at the National Archives. We certainly have students who have this national impact, and we also have students who are really making a difference locally. So students get jobs and are currently employed at the Milwaukee County Historical Society, Milwaukee Art Museum, Milwaukee Public Museum, pretty much every local historical museum institution you can think of, we have students there.
And Nan, as a former journalist, it must be exciting for you to see students today prepare themselves to do another form of journalism, historical journalism, using the precepts that are laid out in your course of study.
If I could jump in to talk a little bit about, I mean, I think one of the interesting things is that we actually live in a moment that sort of craves history and is deeply interested in history. And I think we see that in the battles that are playing out in the press and on the streets and on campuses and in public parks and in monuments. And I think one of the things we're trying to do is equip our students to be critical storytellers. And so, I mean, and this is part of the reason that I find podcasting so interesting and so fascinating is that I'm literally giving my students the tools to go out and tell stories, right? The only thing that is stopping them is a URL and a recorder. And once they get a hold of those, they can tell whatever stories that they think need to be told. And so by the end of this semester, in this class I'm teaching right now, we hope to sort of go out and tell some stories that help us rethink what the history of Wisconsin might look like, right? We have sort of stereotypical images of flyover country and cows and barn silos, but what would a really critical storytelling event on Wisconsin look like? And I think that's what public history brings to the table.
Yeah. Perhaps taking the gloss of that romantic view of the world that we think is out there and making it real, right?
Yeah, or in just enriching it as well.
Yeah, I think also Chris's his examples touch upon really the strengths of studying public history here in Milwaukee and in our program because of the fact that we both have this proximity to both these rural settings as well as, you know, we're very much in an urban center. And so that's why our students can be placed in internships at all the institutions that Jasmine had mentioned, which can be often the basis for their future employment, but as well as the fact that many of our students are also drawn to this field because of a commitment to social justice. And so all the challenges also that a city brings are precisely why they choose to study here at UWM. And so I think that as well as that impulse to want to record stories that might not otherwise be recorded, and as we as a program benefit from having these collaborations with our DH lab, which has the audio lab that that Chris has been actively working with, our fantastic archives, as well as the American Geographical Society Library. So those are great assets.
Fascinating summary. Upcoming programs, any opportunities for the public to see public history in action on the UWM campus this year?
Absolutely. First, before UWM campus, a little farther afield, I have an exhibition up right now at the DePaul Art Museum in Chicago on Japanese-American photographer Yasuhiro Ishimoto. It'll be up through December, open to the public and free. And then coming up at the UWM campus this spring, I've been a part of a multi-UW system project called Lands We Share. And it's a project that looks at the meaning of agriculture in different sites around the state, including in the city of Milwaukee. So we looked at the Walker Square Farmers Market, and we looked at Metcalf Park, which has a set of community gardens. And that will be – the exhibition will be at UWM in late February, early March.
And all of the different programming that takes place, both in the history department and elsewhere on campus, available just by going to uwm.edu. In your case, go to history department, and your page will show all of the upcoming events. Folks, thank you so much for a fascinating conversation today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jasmine Allender, Nan Kim, and Chris Cantwell, all members of the faculty at UWM's History Department at the College of Letters and Science. That's all for this week's program. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week at the same time, everybody. I'm Tom Lejack.
You've been listening to UWM Today with host Tom Lejack, the weekly program where you get to meet the people behind one of America's top research universities, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Playing a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin, UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Learn more at uwm.edu.